On the program today, well, you're just going to have to stick around now, aren't you? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 7th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We have good news and we have bad news about the debt limit with which to begin today. The good news is that Senate Republicans have decided against driving the economy into a ditch. There is a tentative deal to put off a possible default until December the 3rd. The bad news is that there's a tentative deal to put off a possible default until December the 3rd, which means we will be doing this whole dance all over again in less than 2 months. So there is that. You might remember, if you heard the program yesterday, I had a conversation with Mary Daly, the president of the San Francisco Fed. Talked about a lot of stuff, one of which was the two vacancies in the regional Fed president ranks because of the resignations of Robert Kaplan from the Dallas Fed and Eric Rosengren from Boston about revelations about their legal but unseemly securities trading. So the question is, who replaces those two and who decides? Fed Chair Jerome Powell says he is committed to diversifying the regional Fed bank. So Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganser takes us on a walk through the process.
Each of the Fed's regional banks has a board of 9 directors. A group of them is in charge of hiring a new Reserve Bank president, forming a search committee, and usually hiring a search firm. Former Fed economist Stephanie Aronson says the Fed needs to restore the trust it lost because of the controversy around Kaplan and Rosengren.
There's a real opportunity now to replace them with diverse candidates who people will feel are able to represent them.
For decades, the regional bank board members were mostly white men, but that's changing.
It's so much better than it has been historically.
Peter Conti Brown teaches financial regulation at the Wharton School. He says now only one of the 6 directors who'll be choosing the new Boston Fed president is a white man. In Dallas, 2 of the 6 are white men. Last week, Fed Chair Jerome Powell told Congress the Fed will work hard to, quote, give a fair shot to diverse candidates. But Conti Brown isn't sure how Powell will do that.
Has he said that the Board of Governors will veto certain candidates if they don't meet certain categories?
The Fed's Board of Governors in Washington does get a final vote, but the selection process is still pretty opaque, says Benjamin Dulcin, head of the watchdog group FedUp. He wants
a transparent, clear process where they are sort of laying out for the public, like, here's our criteria, here's who we're interviewing, here are the questions that we're asking.
When that process wraps up, the new Boston Fed president will have almost immediate influence. The regional bank president don't all get to vote on interest rate decisions. The vote rotates each year. And in 2022, the Boston Fed gets to vote. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it was an up volatility day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I told you yesterday about natural gas, how it seems to be peaking right now price-wise, more than double what it was last year, and even more expensive in Europe and in Asia. Same thing is happening with coal, supply shortages pushing prices to record highs. But coal is a little bit different. I mean, yes, sure, it's another fossil fuel, but it is one that the global economy is trying really hard to wean itself off of, and soon, too. But if the natural gas that's in short supply isn't readily available, well, energy companies are going to be looking to their old standby to make up that gap, you know. Marketplace's Andy Euler is on the story.
Coal's international price spike can't just be Econ 101, right?
You know, a lot of times there are situations in which basic supply and demand can lead you in the wrong direction, and this is not one of those.
That's Steve Sakala. He's an economist at Tufts University. He says coal production in China has been muted because of COVID-19 and also the country's carbon emissions targets. Now, on top of that, political disagreements with Australia led the Chinese to outlaw importing coal from there, too. And in China, electricity prices are regulated, but coal prices are not. That's according to Clark Williams Derry. He's at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
So the result is that a lot of coal-fired power plants don't want to produce more electricity because it's expensive them, very expensive for them to buy coal, but they're not getting any more revenue from their electricity sales.
Coal producers in the U.S. would love to take advantage of these high prices, but Ian Lang, an economist at the Colorado School of Mines, says the infrastructure is just not there.
Politically, you can't expand a coal export terminal. Like the Western coal export terminals, they're just all been blocked.
Terminals in states like Washington and Oregon have been stalled for years. But with natural gas prices in the U.S. at their highest in over a decade, Clark Williams Derry says some electricity providers are shifting inputs to coal. And that's actually a tougher ask for the industry now.
The coal industry has had to cut production. It's been cutting staff, it's been cutting output, it's been reducing its capital spending. So it doesn't have necessarily the flexibility to ramp up at a moment's notice.
Williams Derry says high natural gas prices without a viable alternative, which for a long time was coal, could lead many electricity companies to invest even more in wind and solar in order to diversify their power supply. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
All right, let's talk environment and infrastructure here, shall we? Back in the 1970s, the federal government started requiring big public and private infrastructure projects, new pipelines, highways, factories, those kinds of things. They had to be evaluated for their potential environmental impacts. Last year, the Trump administration loosened some of those requirements, including the one that said climate change had to be considered. Now, the White House, under President Biden, has started the process of undoing some of those changes, including putting back in the requirement that climate impacts be a factor. So, as Marketplace's Samantha Fields is about to tell us, this may turn out to be a case of the administration's environmental goals bumping right up against its infrastructure plans.
Before the Trump administration loosened the rules last year, it wasn't enough to just look at the direct effects of, say, paving over a stretch of land to build a new highway. You also had to consider the indirect effects.
Like the additional traffic, the runoff from stormwater, the impact on air pollution.
Kim Hunter is a senior attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center.
And you'd have to look at the cumulative effects. So how does this highway combine with the impacts of other highways to hurt things like air quality, water quality, and to contribute to climate change?
The Trump administration got rid of those requirements. Now the Biden administration is in the process of reinstating them. But doing that could actually get in the way of one of the administration's other goals, upgrading the country's infrastructure.
It takes, on average, 4.5 years for a major project to get permitted.
Chad Whiteman at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce says that kind of delay can end up meaning
you're leaving older infrastructure in place, which may be not quite as resilient.
It's a complete catch-22, right?
Shalini Vajjala of the San Diego Regional Policy and Innovation Center says the administration has these two big priorities, climate and infrastructure. And in a lot of ways, they line up.
To really invest in infrastructure in a way that hasn't been done since Roosevelt. And to build up systems that make us more climate resilient and climate smart.
But given the realities of the federal bureaucracy and how long environmental reviews tend to take, adding the climate change analysis back in
could have the effect of slowing down that agenda.
Ultimately, Vajjala says the devil will be in the details, and there are still a lot of details left to work out. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
The virus-induced troubles for public transit and Amtrak and airlines are all pretty well known. Less familiar is the intercity bus industry, the Greyhounds and the megabuses that, while not necessarily known for their comfort, do get people from one city to the next, although increasingly less so. Jake Blumegardt wrote about the intercity bus business for Governing Magazine. Jake, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Give me the state of play, would you, on intercity buses in the before times. How are they doing?
They were not doing so hot. I actually found that they were declining in ridership for years leading up to the pandemic. And in particular, a lot of the operators were closing off service to kind of like rural and small town areas, the kind of like less traveled lines that are still providing a real service to these areas that are not as plugged into the rest of the country.
Yeah, well, so dig into that a little bit, right? Who are the people who are mostly using these buses?
It's often lower income people, people who can't afford to own a car, or maybe who only have one car in their household. And what a lot of the research shows is that people who aren't able to leave because they don't have access to transit, in this case, the bus, because a lot of these towns don't have train service, they certainly don't have airplane service, a lot of people just don't end up going anywhere.
So the pandemic, so these buses are having a tough time. The pandemic comes. I imagine it shuts way down, but then things start to reopen. Do the buses come back at all?
So the buses have been coming back to some extent. And certainly you'll see in a lot of the major markets, they're coming back pretty strong. So, you know, I talk to a lot of riders in Washington, D.C., but those routes from Washington, D.C. to, say, New York or to Boston, those routes are kind of always going to be there. There's, you know, such a strong market in those areas. The real question is what's going to happen to these other places. And I should also say that historically, there were a really comprehensive national network back in like the 70s and through the 80s and whatnot. And we've just been seeing that being pared down and pared down to the point where now there isn't really a national bus network anymore.
Did these bus companies get any of the billions of dollars of aid that went to airlines and other transportation?
So that's something that's pretty surprising, I would say. They did not get anything out of the CARES Act, and they also didn't get anything from the American Rescue Plan Act. Now, they did get some money from the kind of second Trump rescue package that was passed at the very end of his term that, you know, a lot of people kind of gloss over because there was a lot going on at that point.
Yes, there was.
And they initially asked for $10 billion. They only ended up getting a fifth of that. And on top of that, it had to be split between the bus companies, kind of water transport companies like whale watching groups. So they really only got a fraction of what they needed. And a lot of these companies are really struggling now.
Give me a sense of scale here, would you? I mean, how many people ride the interstate bus system, even though it's a, you know, a loosely coherent band of companies, right? How many people ride intercity buses versus, say, take Amtrak?
Yeah, so two times as many people take buses as take Amtrak. It's 67 million, I believe, was the last count, ride the buses, and 31 million a year ride Amtrak. So it's really a much more heavily used form of transportation. Now, that's partially because when Amtrak was brought into the public sphere, a lot of rail lines were closed down, a lot of kind of rail lines that actually service some of these places that I'm talking about, because we also used to have a much more extensive rail network.
Right.
But still, it really speaks to the fact that these buses are providing a really important service.
Jake Blumgart, writing on the intercity bus system for Governing Magazine. Jay, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time and your reporting.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Coming up.
Feel a little bit of that butterfly in the stomach.
A little bit of that spike in adrenaline. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 337 today, almost 1%, 34,754. The NASDAQ up 152 points. That is 1% there as well, 14,654. The S&P lifted 36 points, 0.8%, 43.99. With the advent of fall comes, inevitably, I'm afraid, the season of pumpkin spice, one of my least favorite marketing concoctions, as many of you know. So we turn today the American Spice Trade Association for some guidance. The U.S. imports about $2.2 billion worth of spices every year. And I am happy to report that black pepper is the most popular spice, despite all that pumpkin spiciness with hints of cinnamon and nutmeg and, you know, whatever. Red pepper, also one of the most popular by volume traded. Vanilla slips in when spices are ranked by dollar value, which could be nudging into the pumpkin-y spicy territory. I don't know. Anyway, bond prices, since you asked, they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.57%. Take that, Jay Powell. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's been a week and a half or so since those big German elections, and they are still trying to figure it out. Talks on forming a coalition government over there continue apace. Once there is a deal, Angela Merkel steps down and somebody else is going to be in charge of Europe's biggest economy. There were, of course, a lot of reasons why Germans voted the way they did and why businesses supported who they supported. Particularly companies in what's known as the Mittelstand category, the small and medium-sized businesses that generate more than half of Germany's economic growth. The BBC's Victoria Craig went down to Stuttgart to find out what those companies want from their next government.
This car is unlike one you've seen on the road. It's electric, yes, but it gets its power from the sun through more than 200 solar panels integrated into its exterior. As the company's founder and CEO, Jona Christians, explains, that's because environmental preservation is at the very core of his five-year-old company, Sono Motors.
Everything we do is aiming for that purpose.
Powered by the sun, his prototype, called the Scion, is designed to drive nearly 190 miles on a single charge. And various qualities from its color to its trunk size have been decided with input from 14,000 pre-order customers. Collaboration with buyers and industry feature heavily in Sono's working model. But Christian said he doesn't believe there's been enough collaboration between young small companies like his and the German government. And he'd like to see more support over the next 4 years.
So right now, all the subsidies are made for rather big companies.
Just this year, the government expanded a program to encourage customers to choose electric cars. But the problem for Sono and other smaller companies is how purchase subsidies are distributed for vehicles with a list price just under $70,000. The government and car makers each cover half the cost.
We would like to see a significant adaption of this program to also fit in companies like us who only produce EVs, who cannot cross-finance this stuff with other bigger cars, SUVs, and so forth.
Support for homegrown innovation is one ongoing concern for Mittelstand companies we spoke to. Competition from abroad is another issue.
My name is Peter Weichmann. I'm the CEO of Afios.
Unlike Sono Motors, which has roughly 200 employees, Dr. Weigmann's company is on the larger end of the Mittelstand spectrum. It employs 1,000 people in multiple countries around the world. It makes machines that bend metal into various shapes for thousands of different uses, everything from the spring in your click pen or components in e-vehicle motors. It sells those machines to other manufacturing companies.
We supply all over the world. Approximately 30% goes to Germany, 30% goes to Europe, and the 40% goes to the rest of the world.
Though Dr. Weigmann sees competition generally as a good thing, something to spur innovation, he is concerned about manufacturing in Asia that's on the hunt for expertise of German companies.
I see that is the biggest risk. We have seen that on a couple of local companies here, and that is what I'm afraid of. Because then there is a possibility to transfer technology between the countries, and that is not what we want to do. We want to have our technology here.
Figures from the German Economic Institute show, though, that takeover activity has cooled over the last several years in Germany. Deals in 2017 totaled nearly $14 billion, but by 2019, that dropped to just more than $1.5 billion. As the coronavirus pandemic ripped across Europe early last year, the European Union implemented stricter controls for cross-border corporate transactions. They were specifically designed to protect vulnerable companies from hostile takeovers. Still, some business owners, like Dr. Weigman, would like to see more protections from their next government.
Up to now, there is a difference in quality and in speed. That is our advantage. But we are not thinking that that stays forever. It is a daily fight for us to improve our machines to be, let's say, a step or two step forward.
Whether over competition protection or regulation, one thing's for sure. The deal-making between German businesses and politics is only just getting started. In Stuttgart, Germany, I'm the BBC's Victoria Craig for Marketplace.
Fitness has become a thing during the pandemic, indoors, maybe at home with a Peloton bike or at a gym as they have opened up, outdoors too, hiking and running and mountain biking, even in places where there aren't necessarily mountains in which to bike. Trail networks are popping up all over the place, Arkansas to Arizona, Vermont to Oregon, and as the number of trails has grown, so too has the number of companies that build them. Minnesota Public Radio's Dan Crocker talked to some people building trails in the north woods of Minnesota.
Adam Haryu uses an excavator to move and carefully place giant rocks along a wooded path. His wife Micah follows behind to do the detailed finishing work on the dirt-packed trail.
This is the real sexy part of trail building. Moving dirt, moving rock.
She and Adam own a mountain bike trail building company called Dirt Candy Designs. The trail swoops and flows around banked curves and over bumps here in the deep woods of northern Minnesota.
To kind of get a little bit of lift, to let their wheels get off the ground and feel a little bit of that butterfly in the stomach and, you know, flying through the air a little bit.
In the early days of mountain biking, riders followed old logging roads or game trails or hacked new trails through the woods, often illegally. Building a modern mountain bike trail is a lot different. This one's overseen by the county forestry department and had to go through an environmental planning process. Builders use different techniques to keep water off trails to prevent them from eroding. That requires expertise and meticulous work. It took the Haryus almost a month and a half to finish this 1 mile long trail, and it's expensive.
I would say the sweet spot for high quality professional built trail is in that $50,000 to $70,000 a mile.
Mike Repiak helps design and build trails around the country for the International Mountain Biking Association. Repiak says as the demand for trails has grown, new builders are sprouting up all over the country.
And we need that. We need a lot more planners and designers, especially, and then builders too. We're still a really young industry.
There are small two-person teams like Dirt Candy and big companies like Rock Solid out of Copper Harbor, Michigan, which employs more than 60 people.
Yeah, there's more work than we know what to do with.
Blue Tenbrink's crew is also helping build this new 20-mile network of trails about an hour north of Duluth along the shore of Lake Superior. The total price tag is more than $1.5 million. Tenbrink says good builders have an artistic flair.
I think that kind of comes into what I do here. I like to make you dance through the woods.
And trail builders not only work in the woods, they live here too.
Well, come on into our camper.
This was Adam and Micah Haryu's home away from home for a couple months this summer. They've made enough money to buy expensive equipment like the $30,000 excavator and to deck out this place too. Inside, there's a small kitchen and table, a bedroom.
And a bathroom with a shower, which is clutch to wash off the day's dirt.
The Haryus work 7 long days a week building trail. Adam started about a decade ago when he quit his job at a ski resort. Micah joined him a couple years later. Since then, they've built trails in 7 states.
But the reality is, like, you're sweaty, you're dirty, mosquitoes are everywhere. So it's definitely not roses all the time.
But as long as they continue to land trail building projects around the country, and as long as her body holds up, she says she's in it for the long haul. Adam, too.
It's definitely not lost on us how fortunate we are to be able to do what we're doing. Getting to make your craft and share it with people, it's really special.
The Haryus are working on one more trail in Minnesota this fall and have plans to work in Texas this winter, and they hope to get some riding in too. In northeastern Minnesota, I'm Dan Crocker for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, related perhaps to that setup for Crocker's story. Let's be careful out there. People saw this in the Wall Street Journal today. Data from the Consumer Product Safety Commission showing that at-home exercise injuries resulting in an emergency room visit were up more than 48% from the end of 2019 through the end of last year. Treadmills and stationary bikes were a combined 37% of all injuries. No joke, treadmills can be super dangerous. Even push-ups and stretching, though, were on the list as well. Let's be careful. All right, out of here we are, but not without your moment of economic context. We go out on a labor market note. We got first-time claims for unemployment benefits today, it being Thursday, down for the first time in a month. 326,000 people lost their jobs last week. A lot, yes, but still better. Also, tomorrow, 8:30 Washington time, the September unemployment report. We'll tell you about it. I'll tell you about it on the morning show, too. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? Don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.